Okay, I'll try my best. Thank you very much. It's a very, very big topic that we're trying to tackle tonight. And so I'm just going to give this very short disclaimer that obviously whatever we cover tonight is really not going to do justice to it. It's not going to do justice to either side. It's not going to do justice to any of the aspects. But we'll hopefully try to get a little bit of an overview of some understanding of what took place. The story begins, I would say, in the year 1735. What's 1735? Well, the leading character at this point is the Baal Shem Tov. It's not the year that he was born, but it's the year that's called his Hiskalos, when he came out into the open. He, at that time, in that year, he started to go around and preach publicly, speak publicly, and attract a following and bring a message to people. And it was a message that was very new to his audience. It seemed like a very different brand of Yiddishkeit than what people were accustomed to hearing. Who were his audience? He lived in a region called Podolia, which you won't find on a map nowadays, but it's part of Ukraine. Ukraine is a very big country, and it's part of Ukraine. And it's an area where the Yidden at that time, I would say, were lower class Yidden in two ways. First of all, economically, and also religiously, meaning their background, their Torah background, how much they knew. They had very limited education and very limited means. And what that meant was that they felt like they had a very limited Yiddishkeit. They didn't really know, because in Yiddishkeit there's definitely very big emphasis on limud Torah, on understanding Torah. And these people, they never really went to yeshiva, many of them, or most of them. They could read Ivra. They had a little bit the basics of the mitzvah, of the mitzvahs, from growing up in a house that had shmiras and mitzvahs. So they knew that there's such a thing as Shabbos and Yom Tif and tzitzis and tefillin and davening and shofar. But they probably were rather primitive in how they kept all these mitzvahs. And they were primitive and they felt like it. Meaning they knew that there's such a thing as a Talmud Chacham. And, you know, when he blows shofar, he knows all about the Tekiyas de Me'umar and the Tekiyas de Me'yushav and the Tashrat and the Tashat and the Tarat and what we do with Malchias and Zechronis and Shofaris and the different Shitas. And they didn't know from any of that stuff. They knew you take things and go, woo, you make a noise at Rosh Hashanah from the shofar. That's a lot of the Yidden in this region. That really described their Yiddishkeit. And, you know, they had tefillin, but if you don't have so much money, you don't have such good tefillin, you don't have such good anything. A lot of their things were second rate. So there was, the way it's described in a lot of the history books is that there was a big chalishus hadas that they had about their Yiddishkeit because they felt that it was second rate. Like, you know, yeah, we blow a shofar, but we don't really know what we're doing, so how good could that be? We daven, we try to make time every day to daven, but, like, you know, things like, what do you do if you forget Saint Talmud Levracha? If it's Techedibur, not Techedibur, you know, Talmud Hachamim, think about those things, but we don't know from nothing. We know that you're supposed to daven in the morning, you're supposed to daven again at night, exactly what you daven, how you daven, when you daven. They knew they were missing all of that, and so they felt that maybe whatever we're doing, all of our Shmiras HaMitzvahs, all of our Yiddishkeit, can't really be worth that much. So that's the mindset of the audience. And Rabbi Yisrael, the Baal Shem Tov, he was a Yid named Rabbi Yisrael, who really appeared in 1735 sort of out of nowhere, did not come from a prominent family, did not come from a Rabbanish family or a wealthy family, and those were really the two ways that a family would be prominent. He was kind of an anonymous person, and he didn't go to the big yeshivas, he didn't have a strong education. There's a lot of mystery about where he became so learned. Well, maybe we'll come back to that. But he appeared and he started going around and teaching. And the basic essence of what he was teaching was that what it takes to be a chashav yid, a heilig yid, is something that every person has within them. Even if you don't know a lot of Torah and you don't know a lot of halachas and you can't afford the finest materials, but there are parts of the Torah that, there are parts of the Torah like Avas Yisrael, which is an enormous mitzvah, and things like Kavana in your davening, which is the whole maker or breaker of the whole davening. And if you daven to Hashem and you really mean it and you think about Avas Hashem, it doesn't cost anything to have Avas Hashem, but you have to really put effort into it. You have to think about Avas Hashem, and he would talk to them about how much Hashem loves them and how much they should love Hashem, and loving your fellow Yid, and doing mitzvahs with Hislavos. Even if you're not sure that you're doing it quite right, but doing mitzvahs with Hislavos, can we talk about the difference between a mitzvah that's done with a lot of feeling and a mitzvah that's done without a lot of feeling? And he would emphasize again and again, Rachmana Liba Boyi, like the Gemara says, that the Eibush is looking for a Yid to put his heart into the Avodas Hashem. And with this message, people came out and they would hear this. He was a traveler. He would travel from town to town. He would teach. He would teach with stories. He wouldn't teach when he was speaking to the Hamoin Am. He wouldn't teach with any kind of marmakoymos or complicated shukhtari. He would teach with stories and simple lessons. But the essence of what he was teaching was that Avas Hashem, Avas Yisrael, Simcha b'mitzvahs, Heslavas b'mitzvahs, Mides teves, Anava. These are things that are so valuable, so precious, far more important than whether you what you do when you forgot for Sentai Matal Levracha. So you may be missing those things, but don't worry so much about that. Work on this and you could be tremendous. And then you had this whole population of Yidden that had kind of felt like they didn't really have a place in Yiddishkeit. They didn't really have what to contribute or what to offer, or they didn't have any sense of chashivas in what they were doing. And they suddenly started to feel very differently. They started to feel like wow, Yiddishkeit is geschmack for them. It's meaningful for them. They're meaningful for Yiddishkeit. The Eibishter really does take nachas from their avodah. And that was a real game changer for this population. It really changed the way they felt about their avodas Hashem. And so it spread like wildfire. It became very, very popular. Now, this is a description of his appeal to the Hamoinam, to the masses. What I was describing before, people that were so simple, they really didn't know anything about the mitzvahs, about the Torah, were largely uneducated. But it would be a tremendous oversimplification to say that was the only audience that the Baal Shem Tov was reaching. The Baal Shem Tov had a sort of a two-layered approach. He also, some way, somehow, he had a very strong appeal on great Talmidei Chachamim. Great Talmidei Chachamim. Some of the most well-known, I mean, probably the most famous example of that, but it's not the best example because it's not so accurate. But probably the most famous example would be the Baal HaTanya. The Baal HaTanya is someone that I mean, who's the Baal HaTanya? He's the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. Obviously, he's a follower of Chassidus, a follower of the Baal Shem Tov. And he was one of the top G'dayli HaPoiskim of the whole Tekuvah Sarachrayinim. If you open up a Mishnah Berurah, the Mishnah Berurah quotes him on every page. The Mishnah Berurah quotes him literally more than 500 times. You don't always, not everybody notices it because he's called the Graz. Hagoyin Reb Zalman, but the Mishnah Berurah, just open to any random page in the Mishnah Berurah, look at the Shaar HaTzion, you're likely to see the Graz. He's really one of the G'dayli HaPoiskim, one of the biggest Talmidei Chachamim of the last many centuries, and he was an avid follower, but it's not the most accurate example because he wasn't actually a Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov. Personally, he was really a Talmud of the Talmud. The Baal Shem Tov's successor was the Mezrich Magid. And the Baal HaTanya was a Talmud of the Mezrich Magid. The followers of the Mezrich Magid include many world-class Talmidei Chachamim, including the Baal HaTanya, including the Hafla, including Rav Shmuelka of Nicholsburg, many others. But among the Baal Shem Tov's own Talmidim, I would say the best example that demonstrates this idea that, I mean, again, and there are many, I mean, many. The Mezrich Magid himself was a Rav before he came to to the Baal Shem Tov, and so were many others. But the example I want to mention is Rav Gershon Kitever, because besides being one maybe the best example, but he also is the most fascinating story. Who's Rav Gershon Kitever? His name is not so well known to us. He never wrote anything. That's really what, how come certain Gedolim from any given century will know certain Gedolim, but we won't know other Gedolim. And Lav Dafka, the ones that we know were the ones that were the greatest. But the ones that we know are the ones that wrote something. They left something for posterity. We learned their Torah, so we know them. Rav Gershon Kitever didn't write anything, so he's not a name that's known. Who was Rav Gershon Kitever? So he was the Baal Shem Tov's brother-in-law. There's a very mysterious story here. The Baal Shem Tov married the daughter of one of the biggest Rabbanim in Brod. Brod was the closest big city. The Baal Shem Tov really lived in rural area. Podolia was almost entirely rural, but the big city nearby was Brod. And over there they had Chashva Talmidei Chachamim. And there was a big Talmid Chacham who had a son, Rav Gershon. That's Rav Gershon Kitever. And he had a daughter whom the Baal Shem Tov married. The father, I don't know the father's name, the father had just passed away. The Baal Shem Tov showed up in town. There are legends. There's all sorts of legends. Everything about the Baal Shem Tov has legends. There's very little really well-known factual information. All sorts of legends about how it came about that he got this shidduch. But he married, the fact is clear, he married the daughter of this Choshev Talmid Chacham, and the Kala's brother, Rav Gershon Kitever, swore up and down over my dead body. Why is my sister, who is, from a Miuchas Dikar Rabbanisha family, going to marry this Amaretz, who really brings nothing to the table? He seemed like a simple person, an Amaretz, his very weak background. His job before he got married was that he used to be the guy that brought the kinderlach to yeshiva. He would bring the kinderlach to cheder. He was like the bus monitor. He would bring the kinderlach to cheder, and he was very good at it because he would sing songs and tell stories, and all the kinderlach were happy to go to cheder. But that doesn't qualify him to marry into such a mishpacha. Gershon Kitever couldn't understand why his father was maskim or his sister was maskim, and he said that he basically... Again, the details aren't really known, but it seems that he chased them away, and they ran away from Brod, and he very strongly rejected this guy who came and sort of eloped with his sister. And now this Rav Gershon Kitever, we have independent confirmation that he was a world-class Talmid Chacham. Why do I say independent confirmation? His name appears in the Sefer Luchas Eidos. Now, this, okay, Rav Dotan will say, wait, I have to come back for another shir if I mention the Luchas Eidos. But another major episode that happened around the same time was the Machlokes between Rav Yonos and Apshus and Rav Yaakov Emden. We're not going to talk about that today. But that was in the year 1751. Rav Yonos and Apshus was accused of terrible things. And Rav Yonos and Apshus gathered letters from the leading and most influential Gedolei Torah of the Dar to support him. And he put all those letters together, and that sefer is called Luchas HaEdus. Incidentally, Rabbi Yaakov Emden's rebuttal to that sefer is called the Shires HaLuchas. But be that as it may, in the sefer Luchas HaEdus, which again is Rabbi Yonos and Apshus, who was mamish, the Gadol HaDar, or certainly widely recognized as one of the most outstanding Gedolei Torah, he was handpicking who were the Gedolei Torah of the Dar. One of the letters in the Sefer Luchas HaEdus is from Rav Gershon Kitever. So that tells us, that's sort of independent confirmation, that he was a world-class Talmid Chacham. Now this Rav Gershon Kitever, who, when his sister married the Baal Shem Tov, chased him out of the house, he was just horrified that she was marrying a simple person. In later years, after the Baal Shem Tov's Hiskalus, he became an avid fan. Follower. He totally was machnia himself. He became a chassid, a rebbe, whatever you want to call it. He became a follower of the Baal Shem Tov, even though in Shas and in Paiskim, he knew not 100 times more, but 1,000 times more. But he was completely mevatel himself. So the Baal Shem Tov, he accepted his teachings as as the teachings that he wanted to follow. He accepted his derech as the derech that he wanted to follow. He accepted the Baal Shem Tov as his master. So that's why I think Rabbi Gershon Kitever is a great example of the fact that the Baal Shem Tov's appeal clearly was not only to the Hamayinam, but it was also to the Talmidei Chachamim. Okay, we don't want to run out of time before we get to the other side. Which is, without talking about how he appealed to the Talmidei Chachamim, we'll just leave it at that. That we described a little bit his appeal to the Hamayinam, and he also was very influential with many Talmidei Chachamim, Rabbanim, that came and became his followers. Okay. And then that's the origins of Chassidus. His followers were called the Chassidei HaBaal Shem Tov, and then eventually became just called Chassidim. Then, of course, as you know, there was an opposition. The word misnagid means opponent. Hisnagdus means opposition. There was a hisnagdus to the Chassidim. You know, I mentioned before the Mezritch Shemagid, Rav David Ber of Mezritch. Rav David Ber of Mezritch had a lot of very, very chashuv Talmidei Chachamim that were among his followers. But his derech was that he, after somebody spent a certain amount of time being Mekabel Torah in Mezritch, he would send them out to various different parts of the world. He would send them, you know, to different parts of the Ukraine, different parts of Poland, to Galicia, to Romania, to spread Chassidus. That was the goal of the Mezritch Magid. Well, among the other places that he sent people was north, way north, in Talita, Lithuania. Rav Aaron Karliner was sent to Lithuania. Rav Nachum Mendel of Vitebsk was sent to Lithuania. And the Baal Tanya that we mentioned before, who came from Lithuania, not really Lithuania, but Belarus, which is in Yiddish sources really gets lumped together with Lithuania. It's considered Lita. As a matter of fact, it sounds very funny. In the early sources of the documents between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, when they refer to der Litvak means the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. You know, nowadays Litvak means an opponent of Hasidus. But Lubavitch was very far north, so he was a Litvak. And so these people, Rav Nachum Mendel, Rav Aaron Karliner, the Baal Tanya, they brought Chassidus into the stronghold of Litvische Yiddishkeit, and the chief city up there was Vilna. It was called the Yushalayim of Lita, and the Gadol Hadar at the time was the Vilna Gaon. And over there, that was really the origin of the Hisnagdus. Now, this part of the story, I would say, starts in 1772, even though I'm sure the Hisnagdus was brewing for a long time before that, but the first documented events are in 1772. There we find Rabbanim across Lithuania. Some of the main cities over there were I mentioned Vilna, Brisk. What other city was important in this process? I don't remember. Oh, Minsk. Minsk was a very, very big part of the story. These are all Litvische cities. And letters started to go around between the signed by the Rabbanim of these cities, being machrim against the Hasidim and trying to do their best to stop the spread of Hasidus. So what were their oppositions? What were their complaints and their objections? So, you know, before we described it really in very rosy terms, that here, you know, there were Yidden that they didn't know how to blow a shofar. And they didn't know how to daven, and the Baal Shem Tov was telling them, but if you had to do it with kavana and hislavas and avas Hashem and avas Yisrael, then you're fine. And okay, you know, that sounds very geschmack, that because taka, you know, to a yid that mamash can't do any better, to bring him this message that your avodah is also valuable, avada, that's a gavaldiga message to bring him. But inevitably, what goes hand in hand with that is that if you're putting more of an emphasis on the feelings in the mitzvahs, then it's almost inevitably taking away from the emphasis on the prate dinim in the mitzvahs and the diktuk bahalacha. And so this was one of the major complaints, again, criticisms of the Hasidim, that they were encouraging or fostering a zilzul in diktuk bahalacha. It didn't really matter if you said the right thing or the wrong thing. It didn't really matter if you did it at the right time or the wrong time. As long as you meant well, as long as you have a lot of feeling for Hashem when you do the mitzvahs, that's fine. Don't worry so much about if you're doing it right or you're doing it wrong. And while we could hear that, maybe to a certain audience, that's really just the message that they needed to change them from feeling like they had no Yiddishkeit to feeling like they do have a Yiddishkeit. But at this time, it's a worldwide phenomenon. There are Yidden all across Eastern Europe that are following the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov. And that includes, some uneducated, some that are very educated. And there's a general feeling that the diktuk and the prate halacha are not so important. But even if no one's actually coming right out and saying it doesn't really matter if you're doing it right, but when you emphasize one thing, that crowds out the emphasis on other things. Nobody could really put the same degree of emphasis on everything. And so this increased emphasis on the feelings accompanying the mitzvahs were crowding out the emphasis on the diktuk and the prate dinim of the mitzvahs. And there was a feeling among the misnagdim that what that means, avada, hislavus, and dveikus, and feelings, and avav yira, it's all very important, and it's they're right that you have to serve Hashem with feeling, but you also have to serve Hashem. You have to serve Hashem by doing His mitzvahs, and if you're not doing the mitzvahs the way that the Torah prescribes, then you're not doing the mitzvahs, and you can sing and dance and do actions of service, but the Torah says, I want you to do this mitzvah and this mitzvah and that mitzvah. And if you don't do it with the halachas, then you're not doing the mitzvah. So that was one of the strong areas of objection, that their approach took away from zehiras and diktuk b'mitzvahs. Another very big, big issue was what they were doing to the davening. The Baal Shem Tov and his followers very much, they were looking to shake up the davening. They felt that too many Yidden, the davening was just rote. It was just saying words. It wasn't with feeling. He wanted to inject enthusiasm. Now, boy, did he inject enthusiasm. The early Hasidim, you've never seen anything like it. The early Hasidim, they felt very much that you have to throw yourself into the davening, body and soul. So soul, yeah, that means that you should try to open your soul and feel, experience everything. But body also, because they felt that one goes without, one can't go without the other. So there was yelling and screaming. There was jumping up and down. This was encouraged. Not by all, Hasidus, after the Baal Shem Tov, it was never a unified movement. The Baal Shem Tov, in the times of the Baal Shem Tov, there was one person, there was one leader. But once it was the Mezid Shemagin and his followers, his followers were G'dayli Yalim. A lot of them were G'dayli Terer. A lot of them were very charismatic people, big leaders, people with their own ideas. And Hasidus took a lot of different forms. I should, in accurate history, would have to give mention to one of the least well-known, but most, in this parsha, one of the most significant of the followers of the Mezid Shemagid was a Yid named Rav Avram Kalisker. Rav Avram Kalisker, before he came to the Mezid Shemagid, was in the Chatzar of the Vilna Gaon. And he was counted among the G'dayli Torah, among the Hasid, the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. So he was a Goyin Otzum from the biggest G'dayli Torah in the world. When he came, and he defected, he became a follower of the Mezid Shemagid, and then he became a leader, a Rebbe, the Kalisker Rebbe, and the way his people davened, it was with with jumping, with spinning around, with somersaults. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Berditchever, who's much better known, is also alleged to have involved somersaults in his davening. So, and the Misnagdim said, you guys are crazy. That's not what davening is supposed to look like. Davening is an avodah shebaleiv. Rav Chaim Volozhiner used to tell a story. Rav Chaim Volozhiner is a Litvish Yid following Dar, and we don't have time for the story. But he used to tell a story about a certain Halig Yid in Litta that his davening was so great that everybody used to come to Rav Chaim Volozhiner used to send people to him to for when they needed a yeshua. He would send people to this. What was his name? His name, I think, was Rav Chaim Zolkever, I think. Or something like that. Rav Chaim Volozhiner used to send people to him to daven for Yeshua. His davening, when he would daven, you couldn't tell anything was going on. He would stand stock still, no expression, nothing. And people asked him about it, and he had a vart. It was a long vart, but the main nekuda was, Chazal call it an avodah shebaleiv. That means that if your lave is big enough, there's room for the avodah to fit in the lave. And if the avodah can't fit in the lave, that means that you stuffed up your lave with too many other things. Get the junk out of your lave, and then the avodah satfila could fit in the lave. That was the derech of the Misnagdim. And so they strongly objected to this pandemonium that would take place in the shtibles of the Hasidim. How strict is our time limit?
Not strict at all.
Okay.
Not strict at all.
Okay.
We're all captured.
Okay. We have to include one more. What was really probably the strongest objection that the Misnagdim had to the Hasidim was they accused the Hasidim of being mezalzel in Talmud Torah and Talmidei Chachamim. What did they mean? There's no question that the Hasidim were reversing the hierarchy of priorities. The historic hierarchy of priorities was that Talmud Torah was the highest priority. A Talmud Chacham was the highest kavod, meaning who did we look to as lead? What was the first prerequisite for being a leader, a Manig Yisrael, was that you be a Talmud Chacham. The greater the Talmud Chacham, the more respect he was due. And by the Hasidim, so there was somewhat, partially that was sort of diluted by the fact that they were putting much more of an emphasis on the Avodas Hashem, and so theoretically you could have a mani, you could have a Rebbe, who loved Afka was a Talmud Chacham, well he's not such a great Talmud Chacham, but if he was viewed as being a great Oyvid Hashem in his Avas Yisrael, in his Anava, in his Avodas HaTfila, so he was a Rebbe, he was an Admar, he was a Tzaddik, he was somebody that could be a leader. And that was a reversal of the historic order of priorities. But it went further than that also. There was zilzul in Talmidei Chachamim. Again, not everybody necessarily was guilty of that, but there were real critiques of the Talmidei, some of the more outspoken leaders of the Hasidim, and it's not known whether this was true of the Baal Shem Tov himself personally. The first prolific author among the Talmidei of Baal Shem Tov was the Tullis Yaakov Yosef. There was Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polnoy, whom the Baal Shem Tov called his greatest Talmud, even though he didn't name him as the successor, as I mentioned before, of Dov Ber Mezritcher, the Mezritcher Magid, was the successor. He took over the movement. He was the leader after the Baal Shem Tov. But the Baal Shem Tov said about the Tullis Yaakov Yosef, he once said, he's quoted as having said, that after 120, if he comes up to Shemayim, and the Rebbe Shalom asks him, what did you do with your life? He'll say, I made you one Yasala, meaning this of Yaakov Yosef of Polnoy. There he felt was his contribution to Hashem's world. So anyway, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polnoy, he wrote a Sefer Tehillos Yaakov Yosef, and there are some passages in there. This was written, I think, in the year 1772, the same year that I said was really the beginning of the organized Hisnagdus. There are some passages in there that are sharply critical of Talmidei Chacham of the Dar, like saying that they're not doing us any good because they're not really being good role models and they're not taking care of Klal Yisrael and they're all a bunch of Bali Gaiva and they're only concerned with their own Torah and they're not concerned with anybody else. And these are horrible things to say. And his Sefer was widely burned. You could get it now in any farm store, but it was widely burned in the 1770s. So this was very controversial, and this was, you know, in a lot of ways, the Misnagdim, even if they didn't necessarily disagree with the idealized form of what the Hasidim were saying, but it ended up, a lot of the forms that it took, the zilzul in diktuk b'halacha, the zilzul against Talmidei Chachamim, what they saw as a zilzul in the Tzuras HaTfilah, you know, maybe for a Yid on the Madrigal of Levi Yitzchak of Berdichever, so this jumping up and down and spinning around contributed to this Kavana. But they might very well have, it might very well have been true that the overall effect for a Pashti Yid walking into the Shtibel was that it was just like a zoo and it was, and it was no way to daven. And the Chassidim said just the opposite. The Chassidim said, no, walking into your shul is like walking into a cemetery, and that's no way to daven. And they argued about which is more conducive to davening. So these were some of the main nekudas. There are more. These are some of the main nekudas that they argued about, that they were misnagged against. And there was a period of about 30 years that it was war. It was really there was real acrimony between the two sides. So much so that really it was probably the low point of the. Let me back up a minute. In the letters of Chayrim that were written, it said very, very severe things about the Hasidim, including that one may not be meshadich with them and you're not allowed to shop in their stores. And I think it said in one of them that you're not allowed to bury their dead in our cemeteries. It was really an attempt to cut them off from Klal Yisrael. I should mention, this detail maybe needs to be included, that one of the concerns was that maybe there was a connection with Shabsos, which at that time in history was nowadays maybe we don't really relate to it, but that was really the leading concern in Yiddishkeit at that time was Shabsos. What's Shabsos? Okay, maybe Dotan will get us in 2 years for that. But that also certainly, I think, helps understand why those that saw Hasidus as a threat saw it as such a severe threat that it needed to be stopped through whatever means possible. And the Vilna Gaon was definitely involved in the opposition and to this extent. As a matter of fact, B'Sof Yomav, when he was very old, there was a Chayrim that bore his signature. He never wrote the Chayrim himself, but there were people that wrote, they were like hired Seferim that wrote out the Chayrim, and then the Rabbanim signed on to them, and the Vilna Gaon signed on, I think, on at least two of them. And when he was near the end of his life, there was a rumor that started to go around that the Vilna Gaon had been chayzer from, if not from his opposition altogether, but from some of the more extreme things that he had said in his opposition. And he made a point of sending, he had a gabbai named Rav Sadia, who he made a point of sending his gabbai on a trip around Eastern Europe, or at least, I don't know how widely, at least around Litta, to go in and tell everybody, b'shmoy, b'shem the gra, that no, I wasn't chayzer from anything, and whoever says so is lying. I started to say the low point in the whole fight was probably Chalom Moed Sukkos of Tuf Kuf Nun Ches, if I'm not mistaken, Chof Tishrei, that's the fourth day of, or Yud Tes Tishrei, I think, being the third day of Chol Hamoed Sukkos, Tav Kuf Nun Ches, was when the Vilna Gaon died. And then, it was a very, very sad day for Klal Yisrael. And in certain shtibels, the Hasidim were dancing. They were dancing there, There were those that who took the position of ding dong the wicked witch is dead. That's how they viewed him, and the Vilna Gaon, I mean his stature in in Jewish history, but let alone what he was in that dark, was so extraordinarily great and awe-inspiring that this was just the most horrible affront to Torah imaginable. So then things got even worse than they were before, and then there were rounds of going to the government and getting one another in trouble. Each side went at least once to the government. The Balatanya, who Kiyidu has spent some time in jail, there's a Yontif by Lubavitch, Yud Tes Kislev, is the day that he was released from jail. It was related to that incident. Al-Khabarim, so it really reached its low point at the very end of the 1700s. But like I said, this was a 30-year tekufa in which it was truly acrimonious. And then the tone shifts. And I think the best proof to this is if you look at the Sefer Nefesh HaChaim. The Sefer Nefesh HaChaim, which was written by Reb Chaim Volozhiner, the Talmud HaGrua par excellence, and Nefesh HaChaim is his Sefer, and was written in the year Tav Kuf Pei, at least it was published that year, which is 1820, about 22 years after the Vilna Gaon was Nifter. And it's definitely a Sefer that is Misnagid lechassid. It talks about chassidus and it's misnagid lechassidus, but it does it in a very different tone than what you read in the charamim of the 1700s. He describes them as people who are on the wrong path in their avodas Hashem. But what's implicit in that is that they're people that are truly trying to be avod Hashem, but they're just but they're going about it wrong. They're making mistakes. In the writings of 30 years earlier, they were being called Rishayim. Rishayim and worse. They were really being called Rishayim. There wasn't any credit being given that they're trying, they have a different derech. When Rav Chaim Volozhiner writes about them, he acknowledges them as a derech and avodas Hashem, which is wrong. And I'm here to explain to you why it's wrong. He's not making any compromise that it's partially right. No, he considered it wrong. But he considered them to be true Mevakshei Hashem. So that's one strong demonstration that in the early 1800s the tone had shifted. Another, a more obscure fact, but another good dugma of this, a few years early in the 1810, I don't know, about 5 years earlier than the publication of the Nefesh HaChaim, Rabbi Strom Mishklov, who was also one of the within the inner circle of the Talmidei HaGra, he and Menachem Mendel of Shklov were among the leaders, probably the two leaders of the Talmidei HaGra that were Odel Eretz Yisrael. There was a very strong movement after the Gra was Nifter among his Talmidim to go to Eretz Yisrael. Of course, not all of the Talmidim participated in that movement. Rav Chaim Volozhiner was the leader of those that were not interested in going to Eretz Yisrael, and maybe thought that they shouldn't. But Rabbi Yisrael Mishklov was one of those that was, he was a world-class Talmud Chacham. His Sefer Pas HaShulchan on Inyan Yisrael is a classic. And he was one of the leaders of those that went to Eretz Yisrael. Now, there was an earlier Kehillah in Eretz Yisrael of the Talmidei Baal Shem Tov. Gershon Kitever, who we mentioned earlier, went up to Eretz Yisrael about 50 years before. Or Avram Kalisker, who we mentioned earlier, also went up to Eretz Yisrael. So there was an earlier Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael of the Talmidei Baal Shem Tov. And then in the early 1800s, about 40, 50 years later, there followed a new Yishuv of Ashkenazim in Eretz Yisrael. Until this time, the Yidden Eretz Yisrael, for the most part, the Svardim. And the first significant Yishuv of Ashkenazim in the modern era was the Talmidei Baal Shem Tov, and then about 50 years later, the Talmidei HaGra. Now, the Yidden in Eretz Yisrael, there was no economy in Eretz Yisrael. So the economy basically was handouts. They got supported by the Yidden of Europe. For centuries, they would send Shluchim, we call it Shluchim D'Rabbanon, to represent them in the Kehillahs Kedoshis of Europe, and it had already centuries before this, when the Sfaradim lived there. Nevertheless, they were collecting by the Ashkenazim. The Marshal, the Pnei Yeshua, had the honorary title of being the president of the Yidden of Eretz Yisrael, of Yishuv and Pnei Shu never stepped foot in Eretz Yisrael. But for his efforts, he was a Gadol HaDar. He was Nifter in the 1750s. So he's, you know, the Dar, so like a Dar earlier than the Gra. He was very active in raising money for the Yidden of Eretz Yisrael. So there were these two Kehillahs in Eretz Yisrael, and they both were fundraising in Europe. And I think in the year 1815 or 16, Rabbi Yisrael Mishklov went to the Talmidei HaBaal Shem Tov and said, look, we're both trying to raise, you know, they each one had their own fundraising apparatus, their own organization, their own mailing list, their own shluchim. And he said, what do we need all this redundancy for? Let's just get together. And then there was a joint fundraising mission involving Rabbi Yisrael Mishklov representing the Talmidei HaGra and somebody else representing the Talmidei HaBaal Shem Tov. And from then on, the Yishuv of Ashkenazim and Eretz Yisrael was a joint Yishuv. Even though the Mesnagdim were Mesnagid to the Derech of the Hasidim, but there was no more Melchama between them. So there was a definite shift in the early 1800s. What brought about this, you know, and that I guess really continues on Hayom Hazeh, that they're definitely, you know, there are people that call themselves Misnagdim, and they're Misnagid to the Derech of the Hasidim, but there's much more of cooperation and mutual respect between the two groups. And it's not at all like it was originally. What changed? So there's a number of answers to that, but I'm just going to mention one that, one very fascinating theory, and this is quoted b'shem, one of the Rebbes of Lubavitch, one of the later Rebbes of Lubavitch, I think it's Tzemach Tzedek. It's quoted, I don't know if it's true that he said it, I don't know how reliable the quotation is, but the, whether he said it or not, the Ha'ara is probably spot on. He's quoted as saying that the Hasidim owe the Misnagdim a debt of gratitude because thanks to them, we, the Hasidim, didn't become what you, the Misnagdim, thought we would become. You know, it's a very deep line. What he needs to be saying is that really, you know, look at Hasidus, we're really not so bad. All the things that they accuse us of, it's not true. But maybe the reason why it's not true is because the Gaon and others stood up to the early Hasidim and took the most extreme elements were held in check by the Hisnagdus. Now, the main nekuda of what he's saying is that whether or not you want to give credit to the Misnagdim for holding in check, but the main nekuda is that the most extreme elements got sort of removed. And as time went on, the two groups became more and more like each other. You know, if you take the origin, not that there's still differences, there's definitely still differences, but both sides have been mashpia on one another. We talked before about the prominence of Limud HaTorah. In the early teachings of the Hasidim, Limud HaTorah was somewhat marginalized, pushed out of its place, in, you know, as being at the top of the totem pole. For a very, very long time now, that's not true, or at least not by most Hasidim. Gedolei Torah are Gedolei Torah. The Hasidim have produced no shortage of Gedolei Torah. There have been Rebbes and Hasidim that have been counted among the top Paiskim, top Gedolei Torah in all the day race from, let's say, the mid-1800s, Ad Hayom Hazeh. So in that way, that's changed a lot. And meaning that there you see the influence of the Misnagdim into the Hasidim, and you see the influence of the Hasidim into the Misnagdim. There are themes that appear in Shmuzim, in Litvish yeshivas, that come directly from Hasidic sources. And so both of them have become more like one another. There's a mashal, I'll end with this. There's a mashal that I heard once for Shem the Brisker Rav. I don't know, I can't vouch for it. I don't know if it's true. I heard it once for Shem the Brisker Rav. His mashal went like this. Now, once upon a time, there was a wealthy man who took a chashuva, Talmud Chacham, as a son-in-law. And he made up a deal with him that he's going to support him. The son-in-law said that I like fleishig. So he said, okay, so every day the chefs from my kitchen are going to prepare for you meat and potatoes for your lunch. A year later, he marries off his other daughter to an equally impressive Talmud Chacham. And he says, I'm going to support you. You're going to eat by my table. And this younger man says, I like milchigs. He said, no problem. So the chefs from my kitchen are going to prepare for you every day a lunch of cheese and potatoes. And you're going to eat it at, you know, and that'll be your lunch. So the two sons-in-law never met each other because one was eating fleishigs and one was eating milchigs. So they ate separately. As time went on, the father-in-law, who had used to be a very rich man, he lost his money. And he was no longer a rich man, and he couldn't afford all the fine things that he used to be able to afford, but he still was honoring his deals. He was giving lunch to his edims. But the meat and potatoes was now just potatoes, and the cheese and potatoes was now just potatoes. So one day, one of the edims, one of the son-in-laws, went over to the other one and said, look, your fleishigs is nishkein fleishigs. My milchigs is nishkein milchigs. Maybe we could sit together. The Brisker Rav said, that's what happened here. That there was the chassidim and the misnagdim. Once upon a time, there was chassidim and there was misnagdim. But you know what? Your chassidus is nishkein chassidus. Unser hisnagdus is nishkein hisnagdus. Maybe we could sit together. So that's so the two groups have really become, you know, the differences that distinguished them so much at the inception in the late 1700s, in the mid to late 1700s, really became diluted as time went by. And so that took away a lot of the edge from the hisnagdus. Okay, well, all right, I guess that's what we'll wrap it up with.
Thank you, Rabbi. That was stunning.
Okay, I hope that everyone enjoyed. Thank you for joining.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. Okay.